This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The talented Mr. Ripley has come out on video. On this archive edition, we have an interview with the writer and director of the film, Anthony Minghella. Minghella also directed the film adaptation of The English Patient. The talented Mr. Ripley is adapted from a novel by Patricia Highsmith. As the story begins, a wealthy industrialist wants to convince his son Dickie to return home from the bohemian life he's living in Italy. The father mistakenly believes that a young man named Tom Ripley is Dickie's old chum from Princeton. When the father offers to fund Ripley to go to Italy and talk Dickie into coming home, Ripley plays along with the father's mistake and pretends to be Dickie's old friend, because Ripley's broke and he wants the free trip. Once Tom Ripley arrives in Italy and gets a taste of Dickie's life, his money, and his freedom, Ripley wants it for himself. Rather than bringing Dickie home, Ripley stays in Italy, attaches himself to Dickie, and finally appropriates Dickie's identity. In this scene, one of Dickie's friends, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, is looking for Dickie, who has disappeared. The friend pays a visit to Tom Ripley, who's living in a fancy apartment that he says he's sharing with Dickie.
Did this place come furnished? It doesn't look like Dickie. It's really horrible, isn't it? It's so bourgeois. In fact, the only thing that looks like Dickie is you.
Hardly.
Have you done something to your hair?
Is there something you'd like to say, Freddy?
What?
Do you have something you'd like to say?
I think I'm saying it. Something's going on.
The Talented Mr. Ripley is the story of someone who crosses the line in trying to recreate himself and live the kind of charmed life he envies.
The film asks the question, I think, at a central point. It asks whether it's better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody. And I think at the heart of the film is a kind of debate about the cost of giving up on yourself, the cost of, in some ways, buying into what are, I think, even more prescient messages now than they were 50 years ago about personality, about the value of who you are. I think we live in an age where there's so much of a barrage of messages from the media about changing ourselves, about in some way feeling that we are intrinsically inadequate as human beings, and that what we have, our actual talents, are things we should trade in favor of better hair or better bodies or better lives or better wives or better couches or better something. And so I think what attracted me to the story was the opportunity to look at the moral phrasing of this, and also the fact that as a narrative, it talks about somebody who perhaps appears to get away with what he's doing. And I think the film tries to examine the difference between public accountability and private justice.
What is it that Tom Ripley most envies and wants that Dickie, the wealthy young man in Italy, seems to have?
Well, I feel that if you were trying to compare the two characters, one of them is a man who walks into a room and says, "Hello, I'm Dickie Greenleaf, love me," and people do. And Ripley walks into a room and says, "I'm Tom Ripley, might you love me? I know you won't." And so I think in some ways what he aspires to is the sense of being selected that seems at the heart of Dickie's personality, his expectation of being embraced, whereas I think that Ripley has an expectation of being rejected. I think he feels that he has to lock away who he intrinsically is, because if people actually saw him, they would reject him. And I think that's something which I certainly can relate to, and I think is part of the human condition in some way. I think that one of the, I suppose, phenomena of traveling from childhood into adulthood is an essential recognition that we're alone and an essential desire not to be alone.
You know, as you said, Tom Ripley, the character, says it's better to be a fake somebody than a real nobody. Frank Rich, writing in the New York Times Magazine section, said, "In this age of rampant reinvention, when political candidates, entrepreneurs, and criminals change selves like quicksilver, the talented Mr. Ripley may be Hollywood's most chilling and up-to-date portrait of our national character." What do you personally relate to about the character of Tom Ripley? Because there must be some personal connection there.
Oh, I think I felt huge connection to Ripley when I reread the novel when I came to adapt it. I think essentially it's this feeling of being on the outside of things, of being strange in some way, of feeling too that you have to be secret about what makes you particular. That I suppose it goes back to the sense of being in a schoolyard when teams are being selected, and the fear of not being chosen, the fear of not being admitted really to a life that you aspire to. And particularly in Britain, where I was brought up, where I think the issues of class are tattooed on your forehead. You walk around with second rate and second class imprinted on your forehead. Then I think that I'm very, very alert to the striations of class and to the sense that there's a better life being lived, that your nose is pressed up against the window of a life. And you know, my family is Italian, and I was growing up on a small island off the coast of Britain. So I felt there were so many membranes between me and what seemed to be the center of things. And that, you know, I don't want to make any special claim for that, because I think all of us have within us some reference to what it feels like to be on the outside. And those were my particular things. I mean, I was perfectly happy growing up. It's just that I always felt in some way that I didn't entirely belong. And I think that feeling of not belonging is particularly exacerbated in, you know, late adolescence, early adulthood, which is really where this story is situated. It's very much a story of young people trying to reinvent themselves in the country of Italy, in Europe, which I think had particular attraction to Americans over the course of this century.
What's different here is that, you know, the main character takes these feelings that many of us experience of loneliness and alienation and jealousy. He takes it to extremes. He crosses the line and becomes kind of pathological. Why do you think it's interesting to build a story around a character who we can all identify with, but have him go much further in horrible ways than we would hopefully go?
Well, because I think it's a parable in some ways. I mean, I couldn't help thinking that moment where Ripley says, "I'm Dickie Greenleaf," that it was rather like a Grimm's fairy tale, like a contemporary Grimm's fairy tale, that be careful of what you wish for. I feel the gods laugh at him when he says, "My name's Dickie Greenleaf," and they say, "Well, if that's what you want, you can have it." And it sort of tries to examine the toll involved in giving up on yourself. And so in some ways, it's a nightmarish version of feelings that we've all had. And I think that's what fiction is for in some way, to reflect some of the journeys we might make. Where I understood this film in some way was, you know, partly connected with something that happened to me many years ago, which was that I had written a play, and it was about to be produced in the West End in London. And the director, Michael Blamore, had invited me out to share his house off the coast of France while we talked about the film, about the play. And we went swimming, and it was a wonderful day. And we were sort of on our backs and speculating about the production of this play and what might happen and what I might rewrite. And then at one point he said, "Oh my goodness, I think we've drifted out from the shore." And I looked back, and we were about a mile and a half from land. And I thought, "Well, gosh, I'm going to drown." And I started flailing out and panicking and thinking I'd never get back. And in some ways, that seems to me to absolutely corral the emotion and sensation that Ripley experiences in this film, which is that from a series of rather small missteps that he makes, small lies, they accumulate into, you know, a tangled web. And it's in a way, it's I suppose, exacerbating and polarizing the journeys that we all make. We all are guilty of sins of omission and commission about ourselves and our aspirations. And fiction, in some ways, can give you back an exaggerated version of the consequences of those ambitions and desires.
Now, Matt Damon plays Tom Ripley, the character who desperately wants to be this young, wealthy man who he's become acquainted with. And I think it's really an excellent performance. In a way, the role is about acting, because Tom Ripley takes on the character of somebody else. And Matt Damon's face is really interesting to watch in this. You see him as he tries to cover up emotions. You see certain emotions kind of wiping across his face and then disappearing. His face just registers all kinds of interesting, fleeting things. And I'm wondering if you auditioned him for this at all, or just assumed, based on other performances, that he could do what was needed for the role.
Well, I think the casting process is rather like dating blind. You know, you meet somebody and you try and extrapolate from a few hours with them whether you could go on a relationship with them, on an adventure with them. And obviously you have some prior information with an actor because you've seen the work that they've done. Although at the time that I cast Matt, none of the films which had made him Matt Damon actually appeared. I was lucky enough to see an early cut of Good Will Hunting, and then I got to meet him and talk to him. And what struck me about him really was his own passionate conviction that he was well cast in this part, and his really transparent understanding of the screenplay. And I felt great fellow feeling with him. And it was vital in this film that I did have an accomplice on the other side of the camera, because Ripley's in every single scene of the film. I've never really written a character who so dominates proceedings. But the thing that you mentioned is very true about the fact that a great deal of Ripley's performance, of Matt's performance as Ripley, is about watching and observing and reacting. He doesn't have a great number of lines in the film. He's very much a presence rather than a voice. And I think it needs an extraordinary performance to let you in to him. And I tried in a way to make the camera an inquiring camera in this film, inquiring into Ripley's mind, but also in some ways trying to look at the world through his eyes. The film is full of distorted self-images. It's full of a very particular way of seeing. And I kept imagining that the camera was simply reflecting what it was that Ripley saw in the world. And I think that as a performance, it's an absolutely extraordinary one, because it has none of the frills and bells and whistles and pyrotechnics which, you know, normally dignify a great piece of acting. This is all about staying still and allowing the events of the film to wash over you and let people somehow into the secrets that are going on in your head. And I think he has that amazing transparency. He reminded me a great deal of Juliette Binoche in a way, who I think is another actor who you feel privileged when you look at, because you feel that she's inviting you in to the soul in some way. And I think that Matt has pulled off exactly the same remarkable feat in this film, which is that he's first of all, he's transformed himself from who he actually is. I mean, he's a very centered, blessed person, very intelligent, very articulate, stands very steady on his feet, and has that sort of heavy-footed contemporary gait to him. And he's invented this extremely delicate, skinless, febrile character. And that in itself is extraordinary and sustained throughout the film. But also, as you said, there's something that you feel that you have access to the inner being of this character without using any of the tricks that you might need to suggest that. And he also, within the film, recreates himself as somebody else. So there's a whole series of acting exercises going on, and it's a real dignifying, I think, of the screenplay.
My guest is screenwriter and director Anthony Minghella. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Anthony Minghella, director of The Talented Mr. Ripley and The English Patient. Now, you said that part of the reason why you kind of have this sense of empathy for Tom Ripley is that you felt a bit of an outsider growing up in an Italian family that had emigrated to Britain and lived in the Isle of Wight. Now, which part of your family came first there? Was it your grandparents, your parents?
Well, it's a very convoluted story, but essentially my mother had fetched up in the Isle of Wight just after the war, but basically on the advice of a priest. Her family had settled from a small village in Italy near Monte Cassino, and her father had disappeared off to Ireland, I think to lead a completely new life, and had abandoned my grandmother and her three daughters. And so with the wisdom and the navigation of the local parish priest in Scotland, where they, for some reason, were living, they were redirected down to the Isle of Wight, a place they'd never heard of, and probably they just wanted to get rid of them. And so, which is as far south as you can go in the British Isles, so they went down to the island. And my father, meanwhile, was living in a village very close to Valvery, where my mother came from, and was brought over, as many young men were brought either to America or to Britain, where the wealthy families would pay their train ticket or airfare, and in a way to provide cheap labor. And he was taken in by an ice cream making firm in Portsmouth, which is a few miles from the island. And the people there said, well, you know, there's a girl who comes from a village next door to you in Italy across the way. And so they ended up courting each other on the Isle of Wight ferry. There's a long pier and ride, and I think they would troll up and down the pier in the morning, then my father would go back to the work, and eventually he married and they settled on the island, and I was born a couple of years later.
Well, as a storyteller, it must have been interesting to grow up with such an interesting story about your own family. Were there a lot of stories in your family about the grandfather who took on a new life and disappeared, abandoning the wife and kids?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was the whole stuff of my childhood. My grandmother, with whom I was inordinately close. In fact, you know, I don't think it's the closest relationship I've ever had with anyone, probably. And she and I would walk every morning along the beach on the island, and she would, I suppose, explain the world to me as far as she understood it. She was a very naive and wonderful woman, and I don't think ever fully accepted that her husband wasn't going to come back to her. And even though that they'd been separated for 30 years, always imagined he was about to come home. And I think that was the first insight I had into this whole business of the fact that probably my grandfather had a completely new and perhaps fulfilling and perhaps honorable and perhaps appropriate life with somebody else in Ireland, while my grandmother was fantasizing about his return and the inordinate amount of pain that they caused each other, and which stayed with them right up until after my grandfather's death, where so there were some extraordinary scenes in Dublin where my grandmother and her children went, who are now grown women, went to retrieve the body of their husband and father and bring him back, as it were, because their notion was that this woman might have had him for his lifetime, but they would have him for eternity. I mean, the sort of whole drama of that and just the impact that it had on everybody's lives was, I'm sure, at the beginning of my interest in trying to examine just the frailty of people pursuing what they feel they need and what they feel they want, and just the yearning that people have for each other and the amount of pain they carry around with each other.
I want to ask you something else about your family. I know your father ended up making ice cream.
Yes, he's a great ice cream maker. He's doing it even as we speak now.
Okay, and I think that there was a brand called Minghella ice cream, is that right?
That's absolutely true, yeah.
So were you, I mean, would this have been like being the son of Ben and Jerry's or something, or the son of Seal Test when I was young? Or
I wish it had been the son of Ben and Jerry's.
Or?
I would never have got a job. I just would have retired by now. Funnily enough, I think one of the Ripley experiences I had when I was growing up was that on the island, which is essentially a very poor place, it's a wonderful place, but the 90% of the population live from hand to mouth. But it has this border of large, you know, of rich people, extremely privileged people who descend in the summer months. It's always been, since Queen Victoria's time, it's been a place where the wealthy and privileged have gone to spend their summers. There's a big, boating regatta there every year, Cowes, which is the home of sailing. And so it was very much the experience of my growing up that the island would become full. I wouldn't use the word infested, that was the word that came to my mind. It was full of the young and privileged and gorgeous and wealthy every summer while we were toiling away. And my summers were always spent behind the glass of an ice cream van serving ice cream. And I certainly remember the feeling of not being inside the world I wanted to be in, but rather imprisoned in the cage of this ice cream van. And I remember once driving along, delivering some ice cream in my father's van, and being stopped by two young, very beautiful people who could very well have been Dickie Greenleaf and Marge Sherwood, who wanted me to give them a ride. And so they got into my van, and after a while I asked them where they were going, and they said, "Oh, we're not going anywhere. We just wanted to sort of feel what it was like to be picked up by a local and taken somewhere." And I never felt so humiliated and so clear about my own social standing. And I remember vowing then that I would escape from the prison of the ice cream van and try and reinvent myself. So I suppose that was my most defining Ripley moment.
Before I let you go, I have to ask you, did you ever see the Seinfeld episode? Everybody must ask you this, in which Elaine went to see the English Patient and didn't like it. But her boss, Peterman, loves it. And so rather than get into a fight with him, she tells him she didn't see it. So if he, of course, has to do everything in his power to get her to go because he's sure she's going to love it. Everyone must ask you if you've seen the episode. Did you see it?
Well, you know, I saw a piece of it when I was in Los Angeles. I haven't seen the whole episode. I was enormously flattered that they took the trouble even to... it was an index to me of how much the English Patient had pervaded the public consciousness, that anybody would be remotely amused by this. And in fact, in Britain, there was a much more sort of devastating and just devastatingly funny attack on the English patient was called The Toy Patient, in which they dressed up some bears and, you know, woolen rabbits and played out the story with puppets. And it was much funnier and much better than my film. So, I mean, I just took it as a great compliment, really, that anybody cared enough.
I think
the other thing I would say is this, you know, is that I feel so uniconoclastic as a filmmaker, and it's always very strange to me that people can either be so passionately for or against what I'm doing, because I feel like the most equivocal person in the world. And when I made Truly Madly Deeply, I remember that in 1 week, I remember reading a list of somebody's 10 favorite films of all time and getting that glow of pride and reading that somebody thought this was one of the 10 best movies ever made. And the next day on BBC television, they had a wonderful program where people could consign the things they most hated to Room 101, this program was called. And the very first thing on the next day that I saw was this guy saying, and the first thing I put in Room 101 is Truly Madly Deeply. So it just seems extraordinary to me that such an equivocal person and such an equivocal filmmaker should excite, you know, such extreme reactions in people.
Anthony Minghella directed The English Patient and The Talented Mr. Ripley. Ripley is now out on video. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.